Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a free resource designed for anyone feeling anxious, overwhelmed, or weighed down by life's uncertainties. It's called Peace for Anxious Hearts, a free 10-day text series from Premier Insight. Each day you'll receive a scripture verse, a brief word of encouragement, and a simple prayer to help you turn anxious thoughts towards Christ and rest in God's presence. If you've been struggling to find peace in the middle of a busy, uncertain world, this resource is for you. Sign up for free today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to talk about two things that have been happening in the UK this week. It's very, very hot and we've just lost a Prime Minister. But first, it's very, very hot.
Any relationship between these two events?
I don't think so. But maybe we'll come on to that in a minute. On Monday, after growing weeks, if not months, of pressure, Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced that he was going to be resigning. And this is expected to lead for a kind of uncontested coronation to newly elected MP and former Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham. But hey, we're not a politics podcast, so why are we talking about this? I felt was very struck by the statistics that a lot of the media coverage was quoting, which was that Andy Burnham, when he takes power, will be, I believe, our seventh Prime Minister in the last 10 years. And that 10 years is not just a generic decade, it's 10 years because the day after Keir Starmer resigned was exactly 10 years to the day since the Brexit referendum on the 23rd of June 2016, the momentous moment when Britain voted to leave the EU, the European Union, and which most people would say kind of triggered our series of political crises, rolling episodic political crises ever since. So why is it that Britain has proven itself singly unable to hold on to a prime minister for more than a year or two ever in the last 10 years? Are we becoming an ungovernable nation?
Well, as you say, we're not a politics podcast, so it is, I think, relevant to some of the issues which we've talked about before. And the thing which leaps out at me is changing population with declining birth rates and a growing percentage of elderly people because of rising life expectancy. So the democratic politics, certainly in the UK, and I suspect in many Western European and other countries, democratic politics is being dominated by the interests of the older voter. Because there's very consistent evidence that it's older people who tend to vote, don't they? That the so-called grey vote is a very powerful factor in modern democratic politics.
Yeah, certainly in Britain, as you get older and older, people tend, the turnout rate at elections is much higher. And so whereas the turnout, if you're kind of in your 20s, might be as low as 30%, that's not the actual number, I'm just estimating. If you're kind of retired in your 60s, 70s or 80s, sometimes the turnout there might be as high as 3/4, 70, 80%. And so what this has the effect of is that if you want to succeed in democratic politics, it is, you are incentivized to produce a policy platform and that appeals disproportionately to older, particularly retired voters.
It's worth sort of unpicking that a bit, isn't it? Why is it that older people are so much more likely to vote? You know, what I wonder how much research has gone into that. What are the factors which mean that elderly people are more likely to vote? I mean, obviously, one argument might be, well, they're sitting on their hands in retirement, whereas younger people are desperately busy working and caring for young families. And yet, precisely for that reason, lots of attempts, haven't there, to broaden the timing for polling, to make polling yes. much more easy for busy people. You can put in a postal vote if you're not there, and so on.
There's been a push in recent years to lower the voting age to 16 as well, in the hope to kind of rather than 18, to kind of capture some renewed enthusiasm of people, or get them into the habit of voting before they leave school, that kind of thing. I think it's a complex issue without a single answer. And it's certainly a trend that I think has been seen in other countries as well, that the younger people are less likely to turn out to vote. I think it's a combination of a kind of sense of disaffection and disillusionment from younger people.
If you with kind the democratic of come of age. Process.
Yes, I think so. I think if you're in your 70s or 80s, in your lifespan, you can see that things have got better. You know, if you were born in the aftermath in Britain, in the aftermath of the Blitz, and there was still rationing going on, and now, you know, you spend your days swiping your iPad on your sofa, like, you can see that the system, for all its bumps and ups and downs, did broadly work for you. And I think there is this, and therefore you feel like it is worth it to engage in the political process. I think, rightly or wrongly, there is a sense from younger people that the system doesn't work for them, that whoever is in power, basically, things don't seem to get better. And so there's a degree of apathy can set in, and that what is the point of going out to vote? What is the point of making my voice heard? Nothing ever changes anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure there is a lot in that. I think also, though, that older people, most older people, feel much more like stakeholders. I mean, you know, I'm one of them, because a much higher proportion of older people will be property owners. They will be living in a particular locality that's very important to them, about, you know, services, what the bus services are like, what public transport, what the council activities in. So, you know, we have a stake in this bit of the future. And we're concerned that it should function and protect it. I suppose inevitably, you know, if you're in your late teens, early 20s, you feel that less. You're unlikely to be a property owner. You're unlikely to have very strong geographical roots. You'll be, you know, looking at the world, thinking about the future. So I think something in that. Maybe the horizons of the elderly constricts and contract.
I think there's definitely something in that, and you can probably see that even more clearly in local elections, which I suspect are basically entirely ignored by most people kind of my age and younger, voting for your local councils, you know, with their limited controls about bus timetables and bin collections and planning disputes. But people, as you say, the older you are, the more settled you are. If you have your own children, you care more about schools. You go to the hospital more because you get sick more. Therefore, you care more about who is in charge of the NHS. I think there is certainly something to do with a general sense of greater investment in your local area, a greater sense that you want to see, that you care about what happens to it. I would also chuck in as well, there's a general decline in all age voter turnout in the kind of post-war era, and I think that matches on with other broad, deep sociological shifts around membership of trade unions and sports teams, and indeed church membership. Like, there has been a massive cultural change in Western industrialized nations from kind of 1960 to the present day, which has just seen people become much more individualized, take part much less in kind of communitarian activity. And I wonder if political engagement is another victim of that trend. That's, you know, the same. There's a famous book called Bowling Alone by a sociologist called Robert Putnam, which kind of sketches out in the 90s and looked at all the data that shows how people used to, in America, but the same is very true in the UK and other West countries, people used to spend almost all of their socializing time outside of work with others, doing communal activity, whether that was going to the working men's club, going bowling, and now he was showing how much more common it is for people to do these activities in isolation or not do them at all and stay home. And I think the advent of the internet and digital devices has only turbocharged that already existing trend. that people are retreating from society, in a sense, to becoming more individualistic. And I suspect voting is the ultimate anti-individual act, because everyone knows your single vote makes no real difference by itself, but you do it out of a sense of duty to the community. And I think it's no surprise that that has dwindled away, as our general sense of the bonds that hold our communities together have also been whittled away.
Yeah, I'm sure you're absolutely right. It reminds me that, the process of going to vote here in England is quite interesting, because it's staffed by volunteers, it's sort of very homely, and you've got a sharpened pencil and you go behind a desk.
And it's always in these kind of church halls or community centres or school buildings, and kind of like slightly shabby communal buildings.
But there's a sense in which, you're doing the right thing and we're all in this together, and well done for coming to vote. And
pat yourself on the back for doing your civic duty.
And it's interesting, because I had exactly the same sensation when I went for the first COVID jab.
Yes.
That it was the same thing. There were all the volunteers there, and they were all, tick you off on
very
the list.
Friendly.
And so, well done. And would you like a cup of tea? And we're here to help. And it was very much that same kind of communal activity. And I think you're right that these natural occasions, they're sometimes called intermediate communities between the massive community of the state and the tiny community of the family. And as many people have pointed out, in fact, the church, the local church, is one of the main remaining bastions of local communities, where people meet face to face of all sorts of different age groups and so on. So sort of getting back to the grey vote then, I think it's pretty clear that the grey vote created huge problems for all prime ministers, including Keir Starmer.
Yeah, definitely. So I think one of the big challenges that Keir Starmer faced was effectively a lack of money. The British state wasn't generating enough tax revenue to spend on all the stuff that he wanted to spend on, and so he was constantly trying to find cuts here or there and trying to reallocate limited resources, because he couldn't get the economy to grow, which is not necessarily his fault. That's been a recurring thing for about my entire adult life, about 15, 16 years, is that since the financial crisis, the British economy has been kind of sputtering along in first gear and has never really generated meaningful economic growth. But part of the problem is that he was hamstrung, is that so much of the British state's resources are diverted towards things like the triple lock. So this is a policy introduced by David Cameron, the Tory Prime Minister, who would later go on, of course, to call that infamous Brexit referendum. And this was at a time of austerity. So when there was a big push to cut public spending, funding for councils and lots of other things were slashed back quite aggressively. It's in the 2010s. But at the same time, David Cameron introduced a policy to ratchet up the state pension. And it's called the triple lock because it goes up by whatever is the highest out of average earnings, inflation, or 2.5%. So at a minimum, the state pension goes up by 2.5% every year, regardless of how much inflation might be increasing or earnings are increasing. And this has had the effect, as it is ratcheted on year after year after year, that the state pension has become increasingly generous, which is obviously the point, to lift pensioners out of poverty. But it starts to dominate an ever-increasing slice of the British state's tax revenue, because it doesn't respond to changes in economic fluctuations. It just goes up and up and up and up and up every year. And that's one of the many reasons why I think Keir Starmer was so kind of hamstrung, is that he didn't dare touch the triple lock, because that's become a kind of totemic policy, an article of faith. No one... So goes the belief that no one can win and keep power in Britain if you dare mess with the triple lock pension.
Yeah, and the same, there was a winter fuel allowance, wasn't there, which is a sort of something given to every pensioner, myself included, every year, a sort of block sum, and it's not means-tested. And Keir Starmer proposed means-testing the winter fuel allowance, and there were howls of outrage.
Yes, so again, this was brought in by a Labour government about 20 years ago, at a time when pensioners were more, you could more credibly argue, were among the kind of poorer cohorts in Britain, and it was like an extra top-up money to anyone getting a pension to help them pay for their higher kind of energy and heating costs over the winter. As you say, it was a block sum, so whether you were a trillionaire or whether you were on benefits, everyone got few hundred quid. And that's, you know, an increasingly expensive policy as we said, the population grays and the share of people who are retired gets bigger and bigger. And so one of the things that Keir Starmer, when he came into power 2 years ago, proposed, he said, you know, the economy is in terrible state. The Tories have left our economy shot to pieces. We're going to have to make some cuts. And he proposed means testing the winter fuel allowance. And what that meant was you would only continue receiving the money if you were in benefit, in receipt of pension credit, which is a kind of top-up pension for those who are poor. So again, I would say, as someone who is admittedly many decades away from being a pensioner, it seemed like a pretty good place to start. If you're looking for ways to cut back the generosity of the British welfare system, saying that people like yourself, Dad, who don't need £300 a winter to help cover your fuel costs, saying we won't give you the money, but we'll make sure that those who have already are poor enough that they need their pension topped up by the government, they can get this extra top up on top of it as well. That seemed to me like an eminently sensible and reasonable thing. It would save a few billion pounds a year that could be redistributed to pay for stuff that's actually going to benefit more people rather than just wealthy baby boomers. But no, it caused an absolute firestorm of controversy. And it wasn't just that in the end it had to be reversed 6 months later, which, again, I think played into the idea of Keir Starmer as this kind of dithering leader who was unable to push anything through despite having this enormous majority in Parliament. But what it also did is I think it poisoned the reputation of Keir Starmer in the eyes of many voters. And you read journalists, you know, knocking on doors during election campaigns this year and talking to people and saying, you know, what do you think about the government? And people still bring up that dreadful Keir Starmer who tried to take away pensioners' winter fuel allowance. 2.5 years after that happened, it really set the tone, and I think tells me as a young person that the British state is subordinated to the interests of pensioners, even when those interests are clearly at odds with the interests and needs of the nation as a whole.
Yeah, and it is a really worrying trend, I think, because the reality is that pensioners have a huge range of economic states. Yeah. I mean, as we all know. But, I mean, that's true of any age group, isn't it? If you were to say, well, what about 20s? You know, we're very worried about the 20-year-olds, you know. The 20-year-olds include some very wealthy people as well as some very poor people. So the idea that you just take an age group and say, oh, yeah, people over 65, bless them, you know, they're all very vulnerable. It just isn't true. And in fact, you know, since Celia and I have been largely taking our holidays outside of school holidays, what we notice, you know, when we go nearly always in the UK is the number of wealthy old people who are just clearly living the life of O'Reilly. They are, you know, working their way through their resources, eating in wealthy restaurants, you know, just living a fantastic lifestyle. And these are the elderly who have cleaned up with their property and, you know, the baby boomers. So I think there, unfortunately, there seems to be this kind of lumping together of everybody in an age group. And I suppose pensioners, bless them, you know, it's a very powerful, as you say, totemic kind of, it conjures up an image of some poor little elderly lady living alone in penury, you know, but actually there's a huge number of pensioners who are not in that condition.
Yeah. And it is true to say that, you know, wind the clock back to when I was born and that pensioners weren't on average as a cohort, obviously the average smooths out all that variation you're talking about, were like the stereotype of the kind of poor widow, you know, only able to afford to heat one room and subsisting off thin soup, you know, wasn't entirely a cliche. But what people haven't taken into account is how that situation has changed. So the government's own statistics show that in 1995, and all this is in today's money, 2024 prices, the average pensioner had income a week of about £200. And fast forward 30 years to 2024, and that has more than doubled to £407. So in my lifetime, average wealth, average incomes for people who are retired have more than doubled. And obviously, some of that is due to the increased generosity of the pensions, but it's also due to housing, right? Because as housing has exploded in value because we haven't built enough homes in Britain, people like yourself, Dad, who got on the housing ladder, as they come in towards retirement, they have realised that they're sitting on these huge, huge nest eggs. And so what frustrates, I think, a lot of me and a lot of younger voters is the sense that there was maybe a time when it was legitimate to say, how can we improve the situation of pensioners? But the situation has changed dramatically. Mm. Pensions are doing so much better. And actually now, in work poverty for people in their 20s and 30s is skyrocketing.
Yeah.
You know, these are not people who are work-shy, jobless people of yesteryear. These are people who are in work, but it's such poorly paid work, and the cost of living has increased so greatly and not kept up, and wages haven't kept up, that actually it's not enough anymore to be able to provide for themselves and their family. Those are the kind of people, you know, expending upwards of 2/3 of their disposable income on housing costs in insecure rentals because we haven't built enough homes. That's the issue. And that's what I think disillusions people and says, it doesn't matter who's in power, left, right, Labour, Conservative, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Keir Starmer, Liz Truss, It's all the same. Nothing ever improves except for those who have already made it.
And it does seem to me, I mean, I'm totally in agreement, and it seems because of a combination of circumstances. I mean, this, again, it's just worth reminding ourselves, this is really a very new phenomenon that is only happened in the last 20, 30 years, this combination of increasing life expectancy, increasing health of elderly people. Elderly people are much healthier than they used to be, age on age. And increasing property wealth and so on means that the whole balance and shift of the population it has changed. And unfortunately, this kind of selfishness, contented selfishness of the older generation who just want to hang on to what they have been given, much of which has just been a chance combination of different things. They happen to be in the right place at the right time. And it's interesting because at a personal level, this so much goes against the instincts of parents and grandparents. I mean, the natural instincts of a parent is to sacrifice yourself for your child. If it's a question of, do I want to look after my own interests and watch my child suffer, or do I think it would be better to give what I can, sacrifice my own interests for the interests of my children? That is deeply rooted in parents' hearts. And it's always been thus. Parents sacrifice for their children. That's what you do. That's part of what being a parent is all about. So this selfishness, this intergenerational selfishness, runs completely against that. It's, you know, I don't care about the young. They look after themselves. I'm looking after number one. Thank you very much.
I guess the counter argument would be, I think most people, retired people, are focused on how they can transfer their wealth to their direct descendants, to their children and grandchildren. And I've read reports saying that is now starting to happen as, you know, people my generation are starting to get onto the housing ladder, even despite it being so unaffordable, because they're getting this huge transfer of wealth from housing wealth that is built up by their parents and grandparents. I wonder if the issue is not necessarily a kind of familial hoarding of wealth, but it's more what we talked about before, the breaking down of the sense that actually I have duties and responsibilities that extend beyond my immediate blood descendants, beyond my own core nuclear family, that actually the idea of you know, social security, as it's sometimes called, is it's about pooling, isn't it? It's about we all chip into the pot, and then the government redistributes that money to those people I've never met and will never know, but who need some help, need a hand up, need a help out. And what becomes corrosive is when we start to see things, something like pensions, as kind of like what I've earned, my just desserts, rather than, and people often think about, like, you know, I paid in for 30 years as a working person and now I'm pulling out. Whereas actually that's not how pensions work. Pensions are paid, your pension, Dad, is paid by the taxpayers of today. It's not paid from your contributions and your taxes from yesteryear. Old people are kept in their retirement by the working age current taxpayers of today. And in the expectation and hope that our children will then pay into the system as working taxpayers, which will generate the money for our pensions when we retire.
I'll,
it's that communal sharing and giving.
I'll have you know, I'm still paying income tax, Tim. So I'm still,
okay.
I'm still paying in. I'm a glad net payer in rather than a glad net taker out. But, you know, so we go. So it goes. So yeah. So I mean, the question is, are democratic societies ever going to be governable? Is this what's the solution? How are we going to claw the money out of those selfish elderly, tight-fisted so-and-sos?
Well, this is the real challenge, and this comes back to our conversations about birth rate, which is, you know, no one really knows. The democratic, liberal, democratic experiment has never existed in countries with birth rates below replacement rate. It's never happened before. So we don't really know. It either, you know, our democratic states kind of curdle into these kind of gerontocracies in which, you know, the wealthy elderly increasingly kind of hoard their resources, and or the other alternative is that you get more increasingly radical attempts to try and extra democratic attempts to wrest wealth out of the elderly. And that's why I think it's so urgent that we come up with leaders and politicians and parties today who can find ways of restoring that social contract, because what you don't want is for things to poison between the generations so much that the young feel they have no alternative but to support some kind of, you know, anti-democratic populist movement that promises at least they'll try and, you know, raise, you know, requisition houses or whatever. So, but how you restore those bonds of affection when, as you say, young people are apathetic and not having enough children anyway themselves. Like, yeah, there are no obvious goodies and baddies here, right? I mean, the pensioners are not making young people not have kids. Everyone is just pursuing their own interests in a way that is kind of causing the classic kind of tragedy of the commons, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we all need to be able to sacrifice a bit of our own interest for the greater good. And I think that's where us as Christians, we have to start applying the gospel to this and say, what do we learn from, particularly from about how the early church in Acts cooperated? You know, they had disagreements. You know, I was reading recently about the fallout between the Hebraic Jews and the Hellenistic Jews over whose widows were getting fed in the distribution. You know, they were human beings like us. They fell out. But the apostles realized that the thrust of Jesus's teaching meant that it was unacceptable for people to kind of retreat into these ethno-religious national enclaves, and said, no, we're all brothers and sisters, including those who come from different places, who have no familial relation to you. And therefore, we need to find a better way of pooling and sharing resources so that everyone can thrive.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it is a challenge. I think it's a challenge, again, to, you know, when did you last hear a sermon about this, about, you know, population balance and the responsibility
of intergenerational equity?
And intergenerational justice. And because I think this is where the rubber hits the road. And it is interesting, isn't it, that a lot of this is about leadership, that what effective leaders do is that they actually to present a vision of the future which is attractive and but also workable. You know, this is what it could look like. This is what a society, would you like to come on board and help to build this society? Yes. And you know, without a vision, the people perish. And as Christians, we too need visionary leadership of people who can paint a picture of the future. But I think also the more that a local church family can demonstrate within itself a kind of intergenerational equity and respect and concern, and maybe even wealth transfer, you know, with the more that that's going on within a local church community, the more right we have to say, look, it is possible to our wider society.
I think that's really, really vital. You know, I think a large part of the reason why Keir Starmer failed as a politician, as a prime minister, because he didn't have a story to tell. He didn't know or wasn't able or willing to bring the British people with him on some kind of journey. And I think that's absolutely true in any kind of leadership. As you say, it's about can you tell the story of where you're going in a way that people, old and young, with maybe ostensibly differing outlooks on life and differing needs and desires and interests, can all bundle in together. And that's what the early church had. You see in Acts, you know, they were united with, we have a story to tell, which is about telling the story of this Jesus who died and then rose again. And we are his witnesses to Judea and Samaria and the ends of the earth. And I think that's true of every local church, as you say, as well, that if you can tell a story about the here is how old and young, black and white, male and female, all of our differing interests, all of our sectional differences can be put to one side because we are all bought into this vision by a compelling leader or leadership that can take us together, then maybe you do have a vision to say to the world. It doesn't have to be winner takes all kind of zero sum games between old and young, rich and poor. There is a different story about society. But at the moment, it feels quite, yeah, I feel quite pessimistic, to be honest, about the future of British politics. I don't feel optimistic that any of the parties or leaders we're on offer have good stories to tell or will be able to take people on that kind of journey of sacrifice and national renewal that will be required to get us back to a better place.
Yeah, and I think that it's hard for sort of confessional Christians in national politics, isn't it? I mean, there have been examples of Christians who've been targeted and outed, which makes it very discouraging for Christians who may have a much more grounded and positive belief in the common good and in ways to get there. But the national political circle seems hostile in an unfortunate way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's why it has to begin. I mean, obviously we want believers to carry on getting into politics, and there are plenty of Christians in Parliament. And I'm sure that's true in the States and in other parts of the world as well. But I wonder if actually it is the modelling of this in local churches that can be really profound. You know, in Britain, for example, like churches have already become kind of well-known as kind of vital hubs of kind of social action and outreach, you know, whether it's hosting a food bank or something like that. Youth clubs, all that stuff. I think that's been really powerful. As the state has, austerity state has stripped away some of that state provision, the church has stepped into the vacuum. And then I think it's maybe easier for then the church to say, you know, we don't just actually feed people who are hungry and take kids off the street and give them constructive things to do. We actually also believe in a different way of being community. Hmm. And we model that in our church family. And I wonder if there's something we could witness from those local churches to the political world to say, it doesn't have to be like this. There is another way. And whether that is a more credible way of doing it rather than having Christians try to seize power in political parties and then implement some kind of Christian policy platform with all the skepticism and suspicion that comes in our kind of modern secular age.
Yes, I just had a thought, and that is, you know, it seems that young people, students and Gen Zers and so on, there is a growing interest in faith and in the supernatural and in what churches are up to. I wonder whether for my generation and the baby boomers, it's not that so much as seeing a model of a community living out. I think that for cynical and selfish older people, seeing a model of a local church community where every generation has a role, I think that's a very powerful and countercultural witness.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true.
It seems like anxiety is everywhere today, but as Christians, we know that even in life's storms, God's peace is available to us. That's why this month, to thank you for your support of Premier Insight, we'll send you a special resource called Held in the Storm, Finding God's Peace in an Age of Anxiety. This encouraging ebook explores how believers can find peace in uncertainty, trust God in difficult seasons, and become a steady, Christ-centered presence in an anxious world. Please know that it's your support that makes this program possible and helps Premier Insight continue creating trusted Christian content that equips people with biblical wisdom and hope, which is why your gift today is just so important. So please give today at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. And make sure you request your copy of Held in the Storm, Finding God's Peace in an Age of Anxiety.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Shall we move on to our second part of this story then? Well, second part of this episode, which is the other thing happening in the UK this week, which is that it's very, 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 very hot. We're in the middle of a heat wave, which I believe is predicted, as we record, it will peak around 36, 37 degrees Celsius. I'm sorry, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit for our American listeners, but it's very, very hot, maybe nearly 100, something like that, which in UK terms is exceptionally hot and is close to the record temperature, which I think is just over 40 degrees.
Yeah, 37 degrees C is body temperature, which is 98 Fahrenheit. So, yeah, we're in that ballpark. And of course, in your European continent, it's been... The temperature is well over 40, and the temperatures like that, as you get into the 40s, I mean, you're into very dangerous levels. And there's been a lot of concern, hasn't there, about the health dangers of these extreme heat waves, yes. And particularly for the elderly. There's an unfortunate connection between our two topics, because... there's a lot of evidence that it's the mortality of the elderly which peaks at these high temperatures. So yeah. I think when there's been previous heat waves in Europe, people have noticed a significant rise in mortality in the elder people.
That's right. That's definitely true. I'm sure, no doubt, when the statisticians look at the numbers, there'll be a rise in excess mortality among the elderly for the summer of 2026. A lot of conversation has moved straight on from, gosh, it's very, very hot, to this seems to be happening a lot more than it used to, which the data does back up. And the scientists tell us that it is almost certainly a result of man-made climate change, that hotter summers are going to become increasingly a feature of Western European climate over this century because of the greenhouse gas effect and because of carbon emissions heating up the planet and changing how our climate works. And so there's been a lot of kind of questions of, gosh, it's hot, to why is it so hot? And isn't it terrible that climate change is the cause of this?
Yes, and we talked about climate change some years ago, didn't we? And had some pushback when we felt that we were at risk of being climate change deniers. And I think that, you know, we want to say, both of us, right up front, I think that we accept the basic scientific consensus about anthropogenic, human-created CO2 levels, which are steadily increasing and still increasing year on year in the atmosphere, and its relationship with climate change. But it is interesting that it made us revisit a paper I was interested in that came out in 2021 about climate anxiety in children and young people. And yes. This was a study of over 10,000 children between 16 and 25. It was published in The Lancet, a pretty reputable journal. And it was in 10 countries, ranging from Australia, Brazil, Finland, India, Nigeria, Portugal, the UK and the USA. And what they found was very high levels of anxiety amongst young people about climate change. More than 50% reported each of the following emotions: sad, anxious, angry, powerless, helpless, and guilty. and more than 45% of respondents said that their feelings about climate change negatively affected their daily life and function. 75% they think the future is frightening. And 83% said that they think that people have failed to take care of the planet. And what comes out from rereading this study is not only the very high levels of anxiety among young people, but also this feeling of frustration that it's the older generations that have made bad decisions and continue to make bad decisions. And it's us, the young people, who are suffering, and we are powerless and hopeless.
We're noticing some echoes from the first half of our conversation once again. It's the baby boomers who have screwed everything up for us millennials and Gen Zers. Yeah, it's a very substantial theme of I've noticed, and we did a whole episode which we'll link below about kind of climate anxiety, particularly among young people, many years ago on this podcast. But it's worth revisiting because I think so often. These kind of extreme weather events, these kind of like, you know, tangible evidence you can feel on your face as you go out the house that the climate is changing, that it's true. It's not a myth. It's not a doom-mongering. The climate is changing in an unpleasant way. It seems to send some people, particularly among the young, not spur them into action, but to spur them into despair. And I think there is a sense of, again, this ties in with our conversation about voting, right? There's a sense of malaise and apathy, a sense of, like, what is the point of doing anything? The climate is already doomed. There's nothing that we can do to change it. The people who have all the power, the old rich people, have already screwed it up for the rest of us. And why get angry when you can get sad?
Yeah. And I think, again, proving how much of this is relevant to the decline in birth rates is extremely difficult. But my own hunch is that if you feel despair about the future, whatever the reason for your despair is, that will have strong implications as to whether you're likely to say, I know, let's start a family. There is a link between this deep sense of anxiety and concern about the future of humanity, and concerned about my own life, my own future. It seems to me that must be linked with as one factor in the decline in birth rates.
I don't know. I think I'm a little more sceptical about that than you are. I think, yeah, it's probably in the smorgasbord, in the soup of stuff that is making people feel a bit more depressed about the future. But to be honest, the decline in birth rates set in decades before climate change was widely talked about and acknowledged as a kind of, you know, supposedly existential threat, though, as we'll come to, not actually existential threat to humans' existence. I think there are other things, factors are much more significant. I think I'm a bit of a cynic, and I look at surveys like this and I think what we are reporting is not fact. We're reporting what people tell us that they think about themselves. And people, particularly young people, are notoriously poor narrators of their own thinking and existence, and that's been shown in other studies where they've done kind of follow-ups. But I would be very interested to know, of the surveys that say, you know, some shockingly high percentage of young people say, I'm not going to have kids because what's the point when the climate is so bad, going to be so bad? I wouldn't at all be surprised if a non-negligible number of those, when you follow them up 20 years later, actually did have children. You know, probably not enough children, to go back to our birth rates conversation, not as many children as we should all be having to try and get the population more stable. But I think the number of people who are actually honestly going to abandon previous plans to have a family because they're feeling nihilistic because of climate change, I think that is a relatively small part of the problem here when it comes to birth rates.
Well, again, how much climate change? I think the wider factor about that you need to have some vision for the future. We talked about with leadership. Unless leadership provides a vision of a future which is better, which is worth fighting for, worth sacrificing for, worth believing in, if you don't have that vision, then having children will be one of the things, one of the first casualties, it seems to me. Because choosing to bring a child into the world is an immense act of faith. I mean, of course, it doesn't feel like that At least it didn't feel like that. It never felt like that in the past. Yes, of course you knew, it was unintended. You didn't know what the future would hold, but you just had children because that's what you did, by and large. And whereas I think there's something about the current generation. Maybe it's partly to do with risk averseness and so on. But anyway, I think climate change is in there, as you know, even if the statistics are vastly overrated, if a significant percentage of young people genuinely feel that the future of the human race is doomed because of irreversible decisions made previously, that is going to affect your desire to bring children into the world.
Yes, that is true. And I think that underlines the what we talked about last time. It is that actually there's been a failure of communication, a failure of education. In our desperation to ensure that people understand the gravity of the threat that climate change poses and the seriousness of the problem, there has in some parts of the kind of Western liberal world that has overshot, and people have heard the message, not just that human beings need to stop pumping so much carbon into the atmosphere because it's heating up the world and causing devastating climate change, but humans have already pumped so much carbon in the atmosphere that mankind is facing kind of extinction level event in the not so distant future. And I think if you believe that, then actually a level of despair and nihilism is actually quite sensible. You know, if you think that, yeah, human beings will cease to exist as a species in the 21st century because of actions taken in the 20th and 19th centuries that are now irreversible, then yeah, you know, nihilism and a degree of despair, it seems quite rational. The problem is that's not true, and there is no objective scientific consensus whatsoever that even seriously bad climate change of the order of 3 or 4 degrees above pre-industrial levels, which would be really bad, is not going to cause the extinction of Homo sapiens as a species.
And related to that, as I think my concern, is that, again, there's been so much public emphasis on the need to reduce emissions as being the sole thing to focus on. We have to reduce carbon dioxide emissions unless we're all doomed. Unless we do that, we're all doomed. It means that other elements of mitigation, why don't we really spend time discussing and thinking and practical steps we can take to mitigate the fact that we are going to see more extreme events? And here are some practical steps which can be taken to reduce the risks and the damage to our lives from these extreme events.
Mm. And my conviction is that this is the kind of victim of the culture war around climate change, because for so long the kind of activist and the science and the activism kind of blurred together in places was so focused on defeating kind of fossil fuel energy company powered climate, genuine climate denialism, you know the stuff that we've now seen from leaked documents, you know, where Chevron and ExxonMobil are literally funding fake science to try and muddy the waters and deny that burning coal and gas causes climate change. Because so much focus was on that it got into this kind of sense of you can't allow people to talk about mitigation because that's a smokescreen for the fossil fuel companies basically becoming apathetic and saying, we're not going to do anything different. So the kind of message was, it's all about cutting emissions, and any conversation about mitigation adaptation is a distraction at best, or at worst, another version, kind of denialism cloaked up in less unappetizing language. And that created this kind of binary thing where you have to choose between cutting emissions or mitigation, when it seems to me that all along we should have been pursuing a twin track approach.
Yes, that's very interesting. I think you're right. I think it's the culture wars that it very rapidly became a right-left issue, and I think to some extent in the USA it still is, isn't it? I mean, I think there are significant swathes of the right-wing Republican Party and the MAGA movement that still would adopt.
Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump has made a signature policy of basically banning wind turbines onshore or offshore in America, cancelling contracts at a cost to the taxpayer that the Joe Biden government had already approved, because he just, for reasons that he doesn't really want wind turbines, despite them being a proven technology that generates energy at no cost to the planet.
So at least in the USA, there is still very much a climate war element, a culture war element in all this. But actually, here in Europe, that's not very much less. It really is hardly a factor at all. I think there is a consensus this is coming. But again, it's noticeable that the British government seems to have been totally focused on, at least recently, on emissions cutting. Everything has been focused on how to reduce emissions, and very little emphasis has been put on encouraging people to take mitigation steps.
And the heat wave we're currently living through is actually a kind of unintentional example of that, which is that the main focus of many successive British governments has been on improving insulation inside homes, with the intent that it means that you can heat homes in the colder months for make them much more energy efficient, to therefore reduce emissions, as our, because heating is makes up something about 20% of the UK's kind of total emissions, which is a good policy, you know, with the right thing to do. But the flip side is that actually, when you come, if you're in a new build or a renovated property and it's 40 degrees outside, it gets really, really, really hot inside because your home has been insulated up to the eyeballs. And what we should have done at the same time is, as well as cutting emissions with insulation, is also thinking about what has been long been practiced in kind of architecture and building in hot parts of the world, you know, in India or Africa or parts of Asia, even the Mediterranean, and is how do we build mitigations into the start design of buildings, you know, so shade sails and courtyards and natural ventilation and these kind of things that we know work to cool down buildings in hot temperatures. Doesn't affect our emissions one bit, unfortunately, but it actually means that it's easier to live as Britain transitions from a kind of temperate climate to something that's much more tropical.
And I think the other factor is the air conditioning, because I think because of the focus on emissions, air conditioning is a no-no, because air conditioning is just going to increase our emissions. So therefore, you know, So part of what's happening now in the heat wave is that a lot of schools and public buildings are shutting because they're simply completely unfit for use, and virtually none of them have any air conditioning. You know, in the States, to have a large public building with no air conditioning would have been seen bizarre.
Yeah, and there are plenty of countries where the temperature every year gets into the mid to high 40s. They don't shut schools down every summer, do they? They have figured out how to build buildings, a combination of kind of architecture and air conditioning, to make it livable. But as you say, I think there was this almost this moral sense that air conditioning is morally wrong, as well as that kind of like chippy British parsimony, you know, we're not like those decadent Americans who just spray money around putting air conditioning everything. And actually, that was a mistake, and we are going to have to probably retrofit large swathes of British, both personal homes and public buildings, with air conditioning if we're going to be able to survive even the lower range of climate change we're expecting this century.
And given that so much of our energy is now coming from solar, it doesn't have to increase emissions at all.
Exactly. You know,
we can have air conditioning, which is highly effective and which doesn't increase emissions. So
no.
It's not... There's, again, lack, to use a phrase, lack of joined-up thinking, isn't it? It's the inability to see that practical steps for mitigation is a vital part, and that we should somehow get ourselves out of this terrible culture war. Of course, reducing emissions is also important, but taking practical steps for mitigation. And I mean, another factor I think it seems to be inevitable that there's going to be a rise in sea levels. And it could be a very significant rise in sea levels. And yet again, it seems, in terms of building policies and so on, there's very little practical steps being taken to mitigate the possibilities of floods and rising sea levels and so on.
Mm. And like, this is a complicated one for the church because, you know, the church, and rightly in my view, has kind of homed in on climate justice as a major theme of, you know, what a prophetic kind of witness to Western society in the 20th century looks like. I think it absolutely should involve Christians holding governments' feet to the fire about emissions and about climate justice, in particular pointing out the kind of gross north-south divide here and how the emissions chucked out by wealthy industrialized nations are actually primarily causing immediate problems in terms of rising sea levels and deforestation for some of the poorer countries that aren't responsible for that. So there is a strong moral element to the climate change crisis that churches have rightly been attending to. But I think that has distracted us in the same way it muddied the waters for the kind of secular climate green activists to see actually also there is a practical policy question. Put the morals on one side, but there's also a policy question. How do we live well in a changing climate? That will involve policy, expensive, sacrificial, practical reform put into place right now, when all the effort and money has mostly gone on talking about how do we cut emissions. So, you know, in my journalistic world, I cover the Church of England a lot, and they've had for the last 10 years or so a very ambitious target to hit net zero emissions by 2030. So in just a decade, they set that target in 2020.
This is for the church or for the country?
This is for the Church of England. So this is for all the parish churches, church schools, vicarages, bishops, palaces. They wanted the church as an institution to have net zero carbon emissions by 2030, which was everyone knew when it was set by a kind of synodical rebellion. So the church's parliament kind of rebelled against the target, which was going to be 2045. And they said, no, we have to be more prophetic, more ambitious, and rewrote it to be 2030. It's not possible. We're not going to do it. But it has consumed a lot of money. You know, millions of pounds have been spent over the last 6 years since that target was set, trying to retrofit, you know, vicarages and churches and take out gas-powered boilers and put in heat pumps and change petrol cars for electric cars. All good stuff, right? Stuff that should happen. But we're not going to hit the target. And my wonder is sometimes, was spending 99% of our kind of church budget, both financial and emotional and prophetic and institutional, on cutting emissions for the church? And the church is in itself a fraction of a percent of the UK's carbon emissions, which is in itself a very small percentage of the global carbon emissions. Was that the best use of our time? Or could we have spent some of that budget in terms of finances and time and effort on talking about how can we help make sure that old people don't die in the heat?
Exactly. I mean, I was thinking of, you know, widows and orphans and, you know, isn't that, in a sense, more important than the bishop's electric car? You know, it's there's a huge lot of virtue signalling here, isn't there? That you know, it's we need to be seen to be, you know, in tune with this. And again, that seems to me to go against this Christian instinct for being down amongst the weeds, doing the nitty-gritty, making the difference, taking practical level, and less concerned about the cultural virtue signalling and so on.
Mm. Like it is tricky because I think the church is very alive to charges of hypocrisy, and they're very alive that, you know, if you give us all this and tell us about the moral imperative of cutting emissions, and yet you've made no real effort to reduce your own in-house greenhouse gas emissions, you hypocrites, we won't listen to you. So I think the church is always very worried of, if it doesn't walk the talk, it won't be able to make the case to the watching society and be that prophetic witness. But I agree that it is misleading and unchristian to believe that, you know, simply standing there railing against the injustices is sufficient. God has always called his people to be his hands and his feet, not just his voice. Mm. And you see that throughout scripture. You know, I mean, a silly example, the Good Samaritan doesn't just refuse to cross over the road in the way that the Levite and the priest do. He actually practically helps. He doesn't just say, oh, how terrible, this man has been beaten up, and kind of look around and make sure people notice how virtuous he is. He takes him to the inn, and then he leaves money behind at the inn to ensure that even when he's no longer there, the innkeeper is going to be able to provide for the injured man. Or again, to go back to that story in Acts about the dispute between the Hellenistic and the Hebraic widows, what do the apostles do? They don't do a big sermon. Don't you know you're all one in Christ Jesus and yeah. Gentiles? And they say, no, let's appoint some deacons and we'll put a policy team in place and we'll execute a strategy about how to make sure that no one is overlooked in the distribution of food. And they see the moral case for it, but they don't leave it there. They again go in and do something practical about it to make sure that actually things are improving on the ground.
And actually, you know, over 2,000 years, that has been a hallmark of Christian caring, social action. You're going to see it right from the beginning in the early church in there. It was the practical things. What difference can we make for rescuing abandoned babies and for looking after widows and refugees and leprosy victims and so on. And it's a very noble history going on over 2,000 years. I mean, that's what so much of Christian involvement in the world missions and so on. I mean, the stereotype sort of glosses over all of this and just sees it all as neo-colonialism. But the reality is there's always been a huge amount of nitty-gritty caring. And I mean, Jesus, who was washing the feet of others, who emptied himself. So I suppose, again, coming back to big organisations like Church of England, I suppose in the age of social media and Twitter and all that kind of stuff, there's a kind of hypersensitivity, you know, that at any moment there might be some massive media campaign against us, the Church of England, because we're not, you know, doing X, Y, Z. And therefore we're constantly looking at appearances. I mean, that's been true about the safeguarding, hasn't it? That so much of it is about the optics. And we've said this before, that there's a terrible irony here, because so many of the actual abuses happened because people were concerned about the optics, the cover-ups. And now, lo and behold, you know, now that everything is known, we're still worried about the optics.
And I think I'd want to say, like, cutting emissions is a good thing, a necessary thing, a moral thing in and of itself, even if no one knows you're doing it, you know. And I try to live lightly on the earth and reduce my personal and family's carbon footprint where I can. And, you know, eating less meat and driving a small car with a high miles per gallon, all that little bits and pieces, not taking too many international plane trips, you know. That is good in and of itself, even though I totally understand that whether the climate will not be affected by what Tim Wyatt does. But that doesn't take away the fact that these are still, like, ethically the right thing to do. But my question is that there had to be a twin-track approach. We also have to be making adaptations, which is obvious on the here and now, right? It's no good if I tell my family, I know it's really hot today, but did you know that last year we reduced our carbon footprint as a household by 25%? Exactly. And they're like, Daddy, it's 38 degrees in my bedroom at nighttime. How does this help me go to sleep? It's no good, right? That is obvious on a low level. I have to both cut my emissions and mitigate the existence of climate change. And there are good debates about what proportion of those two twin tracks we should be doing at an institutional or let alone a national level. But I think it's undeniable that we have got sidetracked somehow into pouring its 99% emissions reduction and 1% mitigation, when that's not probably the right or, frankly, the moral balance of those two.
I think that a sort of journalist should take up a campaign here for the for the Church of England.
Stop converting all the bishops' cars to electric cars. And start putting shade sails in all of your church porches instead. Use that one to do that. Or start retrofitting air conditioning so that you can open your doors to people, the elderly and the vulnerable, in heat waves, who can come to a church building and stay cool.
A cold, safe place.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a competition between kind of hard-headed pragmatism and prophetic idealism. I actually think that they should both be prophetic. They can both be us following in the way of Jesus and being the hands and feet in our climate changing world. Good. Well, I'm getting hot and bothered, which is not a good time for when it's already 36 degrees outside. So let's wrap it up there. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'd love to know your thoughts on both stuff we talked about today, both climate change, despair, mitigation versus emissions reductions, but also our first half conversation around the grey vote and ungovernable aging democracies and the challenge of leadership in the 21st century. What have we got wrong? What have we missed? What do you disagree with us? But also, what things should we talk about next week on the podcast? We always like to have suggestions for topics from listeners. So you can get in touch by emailing MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And you can find lots of other interesting resources to read and listen to and watch on Dad's website. That can be found at John Wyatt, johnwyatt.com. Or you can look at some of my journalism, tswyatt.com. And in particular, you can sign up for free to my weekly church news newsletter, The Critical Friend, through that website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.